Good morning. It's Wednesday, July 31st. I'm Shamita Basu. This is Apple News Today. On today's show, how J.D. Vance's upbringing shaped his political views, Kamala Harris makes her case in Georgia, and Simone Biles becomes the most decorated American gymnast of all time. But first, growing signs that we are inching closer to a full-fledged regional war in the Middle East. There were two major developments in the past 24 hours. One, the political leader of Hamas was killed in the early hours of Wednesday morning in an airstrike in Tehran, where he was attending the inauguration of Iran's new president. Israel has not commented on the attack, but Iran and Hamas are blaming Israel. The second development happened just a few hours earlier in Lebanon. Israel says it carried out an airstrike on a Beirut suburb and killed a Hezbollah commander who they claim is responsible for the weekend attack in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights that killed 12 children. Hezbollah has denied involvement in that attack. And so far, neither Hezbollah nor local officials in Lebanon have confirmed that the Hezbollah commander was killed. Israel's strike hit an apartment building in a densely populated residential neighborhood. At least three civilians have been killed, and dozens of others are wounded. Here's how one BBC correspondent, Nafi Sek with Navard, described the scene in Beirut.
From my balcony, everything was clear. I could see the smoke that was rising, and my building shook. I'm close to the area, but my building was shaking. People were panicked in our building.
It's the second time since the war in Gaza started, nearly 300 days ago, that Israel has hit a target in Lebanon. The first time was back in January, when it killed a senior Hamas leader. And Hezbollah and Israel have been exchanging cross-border rocket fire almost daily, forcing thousands of Israelis and Lebanese to flee their homes. Here's the BBC's Kuh Navard again.
Hezbollah clearly had told media, and also in different statements, they made it clear that Beirut, attacking any part of Beirut, including Hezbollah stronghold, will be a red line. And now this red line has passed, and the question is that what will be their reaction? This is what people are asking, and I can see that everyone is talking about that on in Lebanese social media, that they are asking that what is next and what will be their response.
Now, these two deaths of high-profile people in Hamas and Hezbollah raise the stakes for Iran, which backs both groups. Iran's supreme leader has since said regarding the killing of the Hamas leader, quote, "His revenge is our duty." An Israeli military spokesperson said, "Our aim is not for war, but we are well prepared for it." And U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the United States was doing things to take the temperature down, but would come to Israel's defense if it was attacked. This is very much a developing story. You can follow the latest in the Apple News app. Now, let's turn to U.S. politics and the election. Vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance has gotten a lot of attention in recent days for his positions on marriage, fertility, abortion, childcare, basically everything that falls under the family policy umbrella. In particular, a 2021 interview with Fox News is making the rounds from when he was running for the Senate.
We're effectively run in this country via the Democrats, via our corporate oligarchs, by a bunch of childless cat ladies. You look at Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, AOC, the entire future of the Democrats is controlled by people without children.
Last week, he attempted to clarify that statement in an interview with Megyn Kelly that only seemed to double down on his stance.
Obviously, it was a sarcastic comment. I've got nothing against cats.
And in separate interviews from 2021, Vance also said that people who don't have kids should have less voting power and face a higher tax rate. To talk about this, I called up Jessica Winter, a staff writer for The New Yorker. She recently revisited J.D. Vance's 2016 memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, to better understand how his upbringing helped shape his worldview.
His mother struggled with drug addiction. She was often neglectful. She was even abusive at times. She cycled through a lot of boyfriends and husbands, and Vance writes that he often didn't know who he was going to be living with or where he's going to be living. And he found very important sources of refuge and comfort and support with his grandparents. They got themselves together. His grandfather stopped drinking. And I think a really important binary, a really important difference that he identifies between his grandparents and his mother's story is that his grandparents stuck it out and his mother didn't. And I think from his public comments, his policy positions, his ideology, everything that he thinks about the sanctity of marriage and the importance of a traditional family structure, I think a lot of that can be sourced back to his upbringing.
Well, let me just read out a couple of the bullet notes on where he stands on various issues. Vance has said in the past that he is against same-sex marriage. He once said he wanted a nationwide ban on abortion, even in cases of rape or incest. He has since moderated that stance. He voted against a bill that would protect IVF. He has called universal daycare class war against normal people. He has suggested that people in violent marriages shouldn't get divorced. Now, you touched on that last point a little bit, but from reading his memoir, how do you trace some of these other policy positions back to his upbringing?
Well, I think if you didn't get a traditional nuclear family when you were growing up, that can shape a lot of how you idealize what a family should look like. His own very subjective family story informs a lot of what he thinks should be the norm for every other family, no matter what their circumstances might be. You know, his opposition to same-sex marriage and his opposition to IVF, those are things that aren't part of a traditional family. IVF is something that a lot of same-sex couples use to start families. And reproductive freedom and economic freedom are two things that also go together often for women, to not stay home with the kids if you don't want to. And so there is a very strong patriarchal bent to all of his positions and to most of his statements. He valorizes his grandmother, the great hero of his up by the bootstraps story of pursuing the American dream. She was also an extremely traditional feminine archetype. She did not have a career. She did not even have a full middle school education. She was 13 when she became pregnant with her first child. And he saw her as the heroine of his life. But I think to a lot of other people, she might have seemed like a woman who perhaps would have made other choices if she had been free to.
Let's talk about this whole childless cat lady moment where he specifically calls out Kamala Harris and others. But where is this stance coming from? Why this animosity toward women in particular who don't have children?
So I think it's interesting to look at who he specifically called out. He called out Pete Buttigieg, who went on to have two children with his husband, and who has also talked about how long and often painful and heartbreaking their adoption journey was. And so in retrospect, those comments seem even more unseemly and cruel, because this was obviously someone who desperately wanted to have children and was well on his way to doing so. And then to take a very different example, Kamala Harris is the loving stepmother of two children. They call her Mamala. Kirsten Emhoff, Doug Emhoff's first wife, has come out in vehement support of Kamala Harris, whom she calls a friend and a wonderful co-parent. And really, the Emhoff-Harrises might seem like a strange family to attack because they seem exemplary of a blended family. But again, the Buttigieges, the Emhoff-Harrises, these are not the kinds of families that J.D. Vance wants to promote. When he talks about being pro-family, he's pro a very specific kind of family. But I think it's been clear since these comments have been resurfacing that they really rub a lot of people, even some conservative Republicans, the wrong way. There are plenty of people who are childless, not by choice, but because they faced infertility problems. There are plenty of people who are child-free and perfectly happy about it and don't need to be, you know, criticized by anyone for their choices.
You know, I'm struck in this conversation that the man that J.D. Vance is sharing a ticket with, former President Trump, is a person who has had a number of marriages, a number of children with different partners, talk about not sort of the family values image of the nuclear family. How does Vance square that?
I don't think he does square that. I mean, he, you know, once asked someone if Trump could be America's next Hitler. He called Trump America's opiate. I mean, he was so critical of Trump for a long time. And at some point, that flipped. So I think he squares it in terms of how does it square with power? How does it square with my position at the top of the totem pole? And I think it's really as simple as that.
Jessica Winter is a staff writer for The New Yorker. We'll link to her full piece on our show notes page. Let's move now to some other big political stories in the news. Last night, Vice President Harris held a rally in Atlanta. She spoke to a crowd of about 10,000 people, at one point addressing her opponent directly.
Well, Donald. I do hope you'll reconsider to meet me on the debate stage. Because as the saying goes, if you've got something to say,
Georgia has become a crucial swing state in recent years. It helped deliver Biden's victory in 2020, but polling suggested with Biden still in the race, Trump was expected to win the state. Now that Harris is the presumptive Democratic nominee, Georgia Democrats are eager to prove that her early momentum can put the state back into play. Meanwhile, Reuters reports that Harris is planning a tour of battleground states next week and plans to be accompanied by her VP pick. That means we will know who will join her ticket by then, if not sooner. On the Republican side of the race, former President Donald Trump repeated his claim that if Christians vote for him in November, they won't have to vote again in 4 years. It's a statement he first made Friday night to a gathering of Christian conservatives. Democrats have criticized his remarks, saying it implies he would end elections. Trump sat down with Fox News' Laura Ingraham this week. Here's what he said when he was asked to clarify what he meant.
You have to vote on November 5th. After that, you don't have to worry about voting anymore. I don't care, because we're going to fix it. The country will be fixed, and we won't even need your vote anymore, because frankly, we will have such love. If you don't want to vote anymore, that's okay.
Meanwhile, Trump's words are having an effect over at the Heritage Foundation, which leads Project 2025, the conservative blueprint for the next Republican administration. Trump has been trying to distance himself from Project 2025, even though many of the policies outlined in it were written by former Trump administration officials. In fact, The Washington Post reports one of Trump's campaign managers repeatedly called Heritage leaders to tell them to stop promoting the plan. Now the leader of Project 2025 and a former Trump advisor, Paul Dance, is stepping down. And the Heritage Foundation is shifting focus from working on policy proposals to building a database of conservative officials who are looking for jobs in government should the next administration need it. Before we let you go, here's a quick snapshot of what's been going on at the Olympics. Simone Biles is now the most decorated U.S. Olympic gymnast in history. She and her teammates secured a gold medal in the team performance, finishing almost 6 points ahead of the silver medal finisher, Italy. This gives Biles her 8th Olympic medal, breaking the record she previously held. As Biles stuck her landing on her final tumble of the night, the crowd went wild. It was a huge redemption moment for Biles, who pulled out of the event 3 years ago in Tokyo, citing mental health concerns. Before walking off the floor, Biles put a finger up to the sky to signal they are once again number one. In other Olympic news, the U.S. women's rugby sevens team won its first Olympic medal yesterday. It was a dramatic finish, but in the final moments of their match against the heavily favored Australia, the women converted a kick to break a tie, winning bronze. Meanwhile, American tennis star Coco Gauff lost her match yesterday, ending her singles Olympic run. It was a controversial and emotional match. Gauff broke down in tears during a heated exchange with the chair umpire after a line call was initially deemed out, but then overruled. She says there to the umpire, that's not fair, and that one day she hopes the game becomes fair, but it's not. After the match, Gauff told reporters she was being cheated. The Athletic breaks down the rules and says if Olympic tennis used the technology available instead of allowing a human to make the call, the whole situation could have been avoided. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the News app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. Texas Monthly has the story on a DNA lab that cracked a cold case from 1995 and the breakthrough technology that made it possible. If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.